WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Historian Jay Winnick is the author of the bestseller, April 1865. He describes it as the month in American history that could have unraveled the American nation, but instead saved it. It was the most decisive month of the Civil War and perhaps in the life of the United States. On April 9th, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox. But the war wasn't over yet. It could have continued, Winnick says, for months or years. In less than a week after Appomattox, President Lincoln was assassinated, adding to the chaos and uncertainty of the time. Jay Winnick is a senior scholar at the University of Maryland's School of Public Affairs and is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He was an advisor to the late Congressman and Defense Secretary Les Aspin. While he was a senior staff member with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Winnick witnessed civil wars around the world. Those wars inspired him to write about our own civil war.
When I set out to write my book, everyone said to me, what do you have to say about the Civil War? You're not even a Civil War historian per se. And that's really quite true. But because in a previous lifetime, I had actually traveled to a number of civil wars, El Salvador, in Nicaragua, dissolving Yugoslavia, Cambodia, which was the site of the killing fields. I had a number of sort of intimate and personal experiences seeing the kind of dynamics of civil wars and how they sort of just flame out of control. And as a result of that, it both inspired me and gave me really fresh insights when I turned around and set my sights on the American Civil War.
Did seeing the outcome of other countries' civil wars make the outcome of the United States Civil War seem even more remarkable?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, throughout history, what one finds is far too many civil wars end quite badly with terrible, tragic consequences. Think of Northern Ireland, which has gone on for some 200 years. Think of Rwanda or Lebanon or Cambodia. Or think of the horrors today, whether it be in the Middle East or in the Balkans. Well, our civil war could have ended just as badly with the same terrible, fateful consequences, and indeed almost did. And that it didn't really does make the story of April 1865 such a remarkable story.
Well, let's look at April of 1865. That's the month that Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. That happened on April 9th of 1865. What was the circumstances behind Lee's defeat?
What happens is in the beginning of April, Lee's forces were being besieged for some 9 months in Richmond and Petersburg by U.S. Grant. And Lee had actually devised a very kind of daring plan in which he had decided he would take his troops down south, 140 miles, hook up with another Confederate general, and from there they would take to the hills and actually potentially wage a guerrilla war. And everything the Union was doing was to forestall that possibility. Indeed, early in the month, Lincoln said to U.S. Grant and to General Sherman that one of his greatest fears really was that the Confederates would wage guerrilla war. And a series of events would happen during those first days of that month where Lee is doing everything to escape. And, I mean, indeed, there's at one point where the surrender seems potentially to be getting closer, where his men are slowly being encircled. And three of Lee's top generals come up to Lee, and they raise the possibility of that most dreaded of all words, which was surrender. And Lee looks at them, and he thunders very coldly, and he says, "Surrender? No, never. Our men fight far too bravely ever to think of surrender." And then when it does become apparent, though, that they are encircled on the east side, on the west side, on the south side, and the only way they can go is north, the only direction they don't want to go in. It's at that point where Lee convene a council of war, and this proves to be one of the most fateful and really most one of the most important meetings in all of American history. Lee sits down with some of his closest aides, and one of his aides says to him, "No, we shouldn't surrender." He said, "We should take to the hills like partridges and rabbits, and a little more bloodshed now will make no difference." Now, when Lee sat down to weigh this decision before he would decide what to do, he had to think, firstly, could they do it? Could the South do it? And in the end, Lee decided that That was too much. It would not only destroy, he will then say, sitting down with his aides, he will say that a guerrilla war like that would not only destroy the North, but it would destroy the South. And quite presciently, he says, it would take many generations for this country to recover. And at that point, he sort of sat up and he sort of straightened himself and said, and now I must go meet General Grant and surrender, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths than do that. And of course, what's so fascinating about all this is that we tend to think about Lee as being a great military man, and certainly he was that, or a great tactician, and certainly he was that. But arguably, his finest moment comes not in war, but it comes in peace and saying no to a destructive guerrilla war. And it's at that point that he would go to meet General U.S. Grant.
You praise both Grant and Lee for how they handled themselves at Appomattox, in which, Lee officially surrendered. What was the terms of the surrender?
Yeah. Once Lee makes this decision that he's not going to wage guerrilla war, and he says, and now I must go meet General Grant. It's funny because that morning he would don his finest uniform because, as he says, I must now meet General Grant, and I will surely be his prisoner. Well, how will Grant treat him? You know, this has been too often telescoped in history. But in fact, we know that morning, General Lee was actually quite nervous. And well, he should have been nervous because throughout history, defeated generals, defeated traitorous generals, defeated rebels, more often than not in history, had been beheaded or they had been hung or they had been imprisoned or, like General Napoleon, they were exiled. And in fact, that very morning, the Chicago Tribune editorialized, hang Lee, and just days earlier in the steps of the patent office in the Union capital of Washington, D.C., the Vice President, Andrew Johnson, gave a rousing speech to about 1,000 in which he said, we must hang Lee, we must hang Davis, we must hang them 20 times. So Lee did not necessarily, from history, he had much to fear. But if this were surely Lee's finest moment in saying no to guerrilla war, on this day that will also be U.S. Grant's finest moment. Grant finally comes in, and he's actually wearing a mud-spattered private's bus. Now, what's so fascinating, consider the dynamics. Here is Lee, who is in many ways the sole scion of the founding father of George Washington and Martha Washington, and he's surrendering to the son of a tanner, U.S. Grant, who had been a failure most of his life. I mean, it's really an American story. And interestingly enough, what they do is, in the beginning, is they actually talk about the old days. They talk about the Mexican War. Grant talks about how he remembers meeting Lee because even back then, Lee was a great figure. And Lee at one point says, you know, I tried to recall your face all these times during battle and I could never quite do it. And they're talking so long and so happily that at one point it is not Grant but Lee who says, I suppose we should discuss the object of why we're here, the surrender. And at that point, Grant will just handle himself really brilliantly and really presciently. He does several things that are quite important for us to look at. Firstly, he allows the defeated rebels to keep their sidearms. Now, this makes no sense militarily and it makes no sense tactically if you are worried about the South waging guerrilla war as Jefferson Davis was calling for. But what U.S. Grant was saying is we may have defeated you, but we still honor you. We may have defeated you, but you are still our countrymen. He also enables, upon a personal plea from Lee himself, the defeated rebels to keep their horses. Again, this makes no sense tactically or militarily if you are worried about guerrilla war. But once again, Grant is saying you are to be our countrymen again. But the most poignant moment of all will happen when the two pieces of paper are exchanged and then the surrender is roughly concluded and Lee will shake hands with every man in this Wilbur McLean house. And at that point, he starts to walk out. U.S. Grant comes out. Grant makes eye contact with him and he tilts his hat in surrender, a gesture that is then mimicked by all these tens and hundreds and thousands of soldiers around him. And this one small gesture will soon ricochet and echo in every little home and household in the South, setting the tone for the healing to come. But of course, what's so crucial to remember at this point, as we said earlier, that Lee has only surrendered his army. There are still three Confederate armies in the field, over 175,000 men, and the situation is still quite volatile.
Do you think that when Grant allowed Lee and his men to keep their arms and keep their horses, that Grant was taking his cue from Lincoln?
Yeah. Just before April 1865 began, Lincoln would have a crucial meeting with U.S. Grant and Sherman to talk about the war, when it will end, how it will end, and what is to happen when it finally does end. And in this meeting, he says several things. Firstly, he talks about his fear of guerrilla war. Secondly, he He worries that there will be a final bloody Armageddon, and Grant will say, "Lee Bing Lee, there will be a final bloody Armageddon." But then thirdly and most importantly, and again, here is where Lincoln really shines as much as any time in a war. Lincoln says, you know, when this war ends, there must be no bloody work, there must be no hangings, there must be none of that. And of course, what Lincoln was thinking about was the French Revolution, which was heavy on everyone's minds. And Lincoln was saying, that must not happen here. So in effect, what Grant was doing was he was carrying out the vision of tenderness and magnanimity that Lincoln had laid out for him earlier, just before April 1865.
When Lee surrenders to Grant, this does not quite end the Civil War, because there are still Confederates in the field fighting. Who's left in the Confederacy?
Yeah, there are still three Confederate armies in the field, scattered in different departments, both in the South as well as in the West. There's really over 175,000 men. There are three separate generals who will be sort of determining this. And what's so crucial to remember is that even at that point, and just to give a little example, no less than Robert E. Lee's wife, Mary Lee, who is directly descended from Martha Washington, and by marriage, of course, from George Washington himself, she is the step-great-granddaughter of Washington, she will say, Lee is not the Confederacy, Richmond is not the Confederacy. So as Lincoln knew and feared, the situation was still quite volatile. How much longer would the war last? A week? 3 weeks? A month, 6 months? Well, as Lincoln knew and feared, such time spans had been enough in history to start, fight, and win wars, to unseat great dynasties, or to complicate the reconciliation to come. And in fact, as if on a mournful script, that's what would happen just 5 days later.
How did the three remaining Confederate generals end up surrendering?
Yeah, what they will eventually do is they will eventually get word of Lee's surrender. And one by one, they will reject Jefferson Davis's call for a continued guerrilla war, because Davis's government was on the run and he was continuing to sort of call for a continuation of this war in the most deadly fashion possible through partisan warfare. And yet, rather than following him, the generals would follow the words and the spirit and the actions of General Lee.
My guest is historian Jay Winnick. His new book is called April 1865. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jay Winnick. He's the author of the new book, April 1865, about the month that ended the Civil War. Just 5 days after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, President Lincoln was assassinated. What were the motives, as far as you know, of John Wilkes Booth in assassinating Lincoln? How much did that have to do with Lee's surrender?
Yeah, no, it had a lot to do with Lee's surrender. And this is one of the most fascinating and too little explored nights really in American history. You know, it's 5 days after the surrender of Lee. But not only is it the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, but consider what else happens on that same evening. The same time at night at 10:14, not only one, but three deadly assassins would fan out to strike. One assassin, John Wilkes Booth, will murder Abraham Lincoln. Another assassin will stab 5 times the Union Secretary of State, William Seward. And a third assassin will be prepared to plunge a knife into Andrew Johnson's heart, Andrew Johnson, the Union Vice President, but only at the last second he gets cold feet. And what happens is what John Wilkes Booth eventually hoped would happen, is that he would sow anarchy and chaos and somehow prolong this war and maybe sort of undo the surrender that happened when Lee surrendered. And in fact, he almost succeeded.
Well, describe Washington, D.C. after the assassination.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating. What's so important is for us to see it not as we do with the comfort of hindsight in the most powerful, regularized, institutionalized democracy in the world, but to see it through their eyes. And on that night, once Lincoln was shot and assassinated and Seward was stabbed 5 times and Johnson was targeted, the Union was in such chaos that people literally feared being murdered in their beds. Indeed, the Chief Justice would say it was a night of horrors, and in fact, it was a night of horrors. Indeed, there was such chaos and turmoil that night in Washington that the Union cabinet would soon be discussing whether or not, in effect, a Napoleonic coup was underway. And of all people, they actually thought their own great general, Bill Sherman, was behind it. And in fact, the New York Times would write that evening, or actually the next day, I should say, they would write that if this were France, all of the country would be in bloody revolution by the next day. So there was a lot that had to be handled that evening. And then in addition to that, there's one other thing, the transition to who becomes president, because it was actually far murkier than we tend to think of it.
Well, you know, I think there were two things a minimum of two things that could have gone wrong. First of all, the assassination could have opened up an opportunity for the Confederates to resume the war. But second of all, there were cries in the North for revenge against Lincoln's murder, cries of revenge that could have also led to chaos.
Right. It potentially could have led to the very scenario that Lincoln never wanted, which is this kind of bloodbath of retribution and vengeance and hangings and all the rest. And that was one thing that had to be avoided. Another thing was the opportunity to continue the war, because at the point that this decapitation of the Union government is taking place, General Lee is back in Richmond safely at his home. And if Lee were Milosevic or Yasser Arafat, or you pick your favorite strongman on the world stage today, you can bet that he surely would have taken advantage of this to perhaps give a wink and nod and say, let's try a little guerrilla warfare and take advantage of this fleeting weakness.
Now, there's a lot of concern that Andrew Johnson, although he was picked by Abraham Lincoln to be the vice president, there was concern that Johnson would be a terrible president. Why were so many people so worried?
Yeah, well, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Johnson had only met with Lincoln once. And quite by happenstance, that was on the day that when Lincoln was assassinated for only 30 minutes. And to this day, we don't know what they talked about. But more importantly, Johnson was a relative newcomer to the administration. He wasn't of the Republican Party. He was an outsider. And more than anything else, Johnson was widely written off as a drunkard and a buffoon in the Washington establishment. And he was a man who nobody ever thought of as being president. And when he assumed it, people were really kind of stunned.
Well, what do you think saves the day after Lincoln's assassination and prevents the Confederates from taking up arms again and prevents the North from seeking revenge for the murder of Lincoln?
Yeah. No, that's really a good question. I mean, if we look around the world today at the civil wars that seem to kind of persist with this melancholy regularity, what we see is it always takes two sides to create the peace. And in our case, in April 1865, we would be fortunate to have leaders on two different sides who would really do much to sort of create the healing and the reconciliation. First and foremost, more than anyone, there was Abraham Lincoln, who really did have the genius and the foresight and the wisdom to know that how this war ends is every bit as crucial as how it was fought. And it was Lincoln who talked about binding up the wounds. It was Lincoln who said at City Point to Grant and Sherman, there must be no bloody work, there must be no hangings. So even when Lincoln was assassinated and when Lincoln was dead, it would be Lincoln's vision that would sort of guide the surrenders where the Northern generals would receive their counterparts, foremost Grant, who acted brilliantly at Appomattox. But General Sherman would also act equally with magnanimity and dignity at Durham Station when he receives Joe Johnston's surrender. And so these leaders will do much in the North to kind of quell the calls for vengeance and for hatred. In fact, at one point, General Lee is actually indicted, and Grant will step forward and say if Lee is indicted and it stands, he will actually he raised the specter of he could even resign. He said it must not happen, and so the indictment was quashed. And then equally important is that there was not only these men on the northern side, but on the southern side. Robert E. Lee, having always been the nemesis for Abraham Lincoln, ironically will become Lincoln's partner in peace at the end of the war, because Lee will do much to kind of continue the efforts to quell this the continuation of the war through a deadly guerrilla effort.
Of course, one thing we have to consider is that when the Civil War ended and the United States was unified again, the South started to erect really racist laws, and although slavery was illegal, African Americans still had few, if any, rights in the South for quite a while.
Yeah, no. What would later follow was just a tragedy in every way, shape, and form. And one of the ways I think about this is I think, you know, had Lincoln lived, he would have wept at the tragedy of Reconstruction, and he would have seen it as a flawed nightmare in every respect. I also think he would have wept at some of what happened in the North as well, where there were also continuing elements of racism just in a different form from what happened in the South. But there is no doubt that the continuing struggle for civil rights and for true freedom and true equality would really take another 90 or 100 years, and of course many argue that it's a struggle that continues to this day. But what's crucial to remember is that's a very different kind of chapter and story than us becoming like a Northern Ireland or a Middle East or a Balkans.
You used to work in government as an aide to Les Aspin. Have your views of American government changed, or American leadership changed, as a result of writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I've changed in all sorts of ways. A lot of things I used to think when I was in government, I don't think anymore after having spent 4 years reflecting on how this country kind of emerged out of the turmoil of the Civil War and somehow survived. What I really come out of this believing is people make history, leaders, men and women. And you know, there's a reason, I guess, why we have such bitter debates over who becomes president or over who becomes our most senior general or over who takes cabinet positions, because it's not simply just the policies or the government per se, but if men and women at the top decide to pervert the institutions of government, they could do that. But in the final analysis, I think it's really these people who at crucial moments are either shaped by history or shape history. And here we really see why leadership so matters. I mean, I'm convinced that April 1865 isn't a final analysis, a story of leadership on both sides.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jay Winnick is the author of April 1865. He's a senior scholar at the University of Maryland's School of Public Affairs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.